I know you're out there. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you.
The Chris Ann Hall Show.
Any varmint that crosses that lady's path has met its match. Come on!
Rise and shine, liberty-loving patriots. Samuel Adams wrote in 1772, among the natural rights of the colonists are these. First, a right to life. Secondly, to liberty. Thirdly, to property, together with the right to support and defend them in the best manner they can. These are evident branches of, rather than deductions from, the duty of self-preservation, commonly called the first law of nature. Remember that aspect of laws of nature and of nature's God. Samuel Adams continues and says, all men have a right to remain in a state of nature as long as they please. And in the case of intolerable oppression, civil or religious, to leave the society they belong to and enter into another. When men enter into society, he says, it's by voluntary consent, and they have a right to demand and insist upon the performance of such conditions and previous limitations as form an equitable original compact. And every natural right, not expressly given up or from the nature of a social compact, necessarily ceded, remains. And here's the key. All positive and civil laws should conform, as far as possible, to the law of natural reason and equity. You see, we have a right to life, liberty, and property. And all positive and civil laws should conform as far as possible to the law of natural reason and equity. What is that natural right? The fact that we have the right to live outside of intolerable oppression. But what happens when the positive and civil laws become oppressive? Interesting to know that our framers said that we have a right to defend our life, our liberty, and our property when our laws become oppressive. Isn't that interesting? Because that's exactly what Samuel Adams said. First, a right to life. Secondly, to liberty. Thirdly, to property, together with a right to support and defend them in the best manner they can. When your life, your liberty, and your property are under attack by the very laws that were created under the guise of supporting life, liberty, and property, what do you do? Well, it's interesting because Bastiat wrote a series of essays, and in one of those essays called The Law, he says, there is in all of us a strong disposition to regard what is lawful as legitimate. So much so that many falsely derive all justice from law. You know, it's very interesting because I see this argument. It's a matter of natural tendencies of people. It's a matter of human nature. As a matter of fact, Jefferson talked about that in the Declaration of Independence. He says, prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms which they are accustomed. See, we're more likely to tolerate things that we've become accustomed to, which is why the whole idea of governments becoming tyrannical over time, you know, the frog in the pot of water analogy. That's the way it happens, because tyrants know that you can't be so tyrannical so fast that you'll actually show your hand. But the truth of the matter is that history has proven that this is the way it happens over time. Because mankind are more disposed to suffer, while evils are sufferable, than to right themselves by abolishing the forms which they are accustomed. And the interesting thing is that this has been written throughout history. And people understand this to be so. So can we talk about law for just a second today? Can we talk about this? Bastiat said, "We hold from God the gift which, as far as we are concerned, contains all others, life, physical, intellectual, and moral life. But life cannot support itself. He who hath bestowed it has entrusted us with the care of supporting it, of developing it, and of perfecting it. To that end, he has provided us with a collection of wonderful faculties. He has plunged us into the midst of various elements. It is by the application of our faculties that these elements, that the phenomena of assimilation and appropriation, by which life pursues the circle which has been assigned to it, are realized." You see, it is not because men have made laws that personality, liberty, and property exist. On the contrary, it's because personality, liberty, and property exist beforehand that men make laws. Bastiat's just simply telling us we have a natural right to life, liberty, and property. That's exactly what Samuel Adams wrote in 1772. Bastiat's just coming along 100 years later and saying, hey, this guy knew what he was talking about. You don't have to have government to have life. Government doesn't give you liberty. And you have always had a right to property. We owned property long before we ever had government. But because of life, liberty, and property, we create laws. Bastiat says, "What then is law? As I have said elsewhere, it is the collective organization of the individual's right to lawful defense. Nature, or rather God, he says, has bestowed upon every one of us the right to defend his person, his liberty, and his property, since these are the three constituent or preserving elements of life. Elements, each of which has rendered complete by the others, and cannot be understood without them. For what are our faculties but the extension of our personality? What is property but the extension of our faculties?" You see, you own property. You choose to own a property based on your life and your liberty. You have liberty based upon your life. And the government does not give you life. He says, "If every man has the right of defending, even by force, his person, his liberty, and his property, a number of men have the right to combine together, to extend, to organize a common force, to provide regularly for this defense." A collective right, then, has its principle, its reason for existing, its lawfulness, its individual right. And the common force cannot rationally have any other end or any other mission than that of the isolated forces for which it substituted. Meaning, when people come together and form a collective right to protect life, liberty, and property, that collective right cannot work for the opposite of that individual right. An individual law cannot take a person's life, liberty, or property, because for the same reason you created the common force, life, liberty, and property. The law cannot be used to destroy the person's, their liberty, or their property, because it was created for its defense. Bastiat says, for this perversion of force would be, in one case as in the other, a contradiction to our premises. But you see, we must have lost our way. We must have lost our understanding that the reason we've come together as a community for our mutual defense. See, that's why Thomas Paine said governments in its best form are a necessary evil. Because the purpose of government is, as Bastiat said, is a collective right of the people to come together to protect their life, their liberty, and their property. And it becomes a contradiction when that collective right is asserted against us for this very same purpose. How is it that the people can collect together in a force to deprive the individual of life, liberty, and property when there's been no crime? So the collective force to protect life says that murder is unlawful. And if you murder someone, you have to be punished. The collective right to say that property is our inherent right, and you cannot steal someone's property. And if you do so, you must be punished. Because you see, morality has a tendency to lose its force the larger societies become, because you become disassociated with your neighbor, and without it, that intimate attachment with your neighbor, then immorality can persuade you to do things that you wouldn't do if you were intimately associated with a person. And so laws become necessary to protect our life, liberty, and our property when our societies become so big that we are no longer able to govern ourselves. But what happens when those laws no longer punish people, but reward them for their plunder? What do you do then?
Chris Ann Hall Show. She's Liberty's lobbyist.
There's a better understanding of law. What is law? It is the collective organization of the individual right to lawful defense. What happens when that law becomes perverted? If the purpose of law is to protect the individual right and a collective exertion of our individual right to lawful defense, what happens when that law becomes perverted? Bastiat says there's a contradiction then in our premise. The law is the organization of the natural right of lawful defense. It is the substitution of collective for the individual forces, for the purpose of acting in the sphere which they have the right to act, and of doing what they have the right to do, to secure persons, liberties, and properties, and to maintain each in its rights, so as to cause justice to reign over all. This is the basis upon which laws and societies exist. And in order to keep law in its proper perspective, you must remember, as Samuel Adams said, it is a natural right of the people to have life, liberty, and property. But when the law becomes the mechanism to plunder life, liberty, and property, what happens to us? Well, Bastiat tells us very specifically, there is in all of us a strong disposition to regard what is lawful as legitimate. So much so that many falsely derive all justice from law. Do you know what that means? That means that we have a natural tendency to say, well, it's the law, therefore it must be good. And that we come up with this false understanding that we need laws to stop crimes. Laws stop crimes. No, they don't. Laws don't stop crimes. There's no law on the planet that has ever stopped a crime. There are only two things that will stop people from doing bad things, and that's morality and force. The efficacy of law is the threat of force. If laws stopped crimes, we would be a crime-free country because we have way too many laws. So what do? When the laws supplant our morality, what do? When we live under this false belief that laws make people good? I mean, I think that many people who will be listening to this show will agree on the surface and superficially that laws don't stop crimes. But it's a matter of human nature then to cry out to government to create laws to keep us safe. It's a contradiction. Laws don't keep us safe. The only thing that laws are supposed to do is punish people for doing bad things in an effort to protect life, liberty, and property. But it doesn't keep us safe. And laws don't protect. They punish. You know, the criminal justice system was not designed to keep us safe. The criminal justice system was not designed to stop crimes. The criminal justice system was designed to identify criminal activity. You cannot deny me of my life, my liberty, or my property by force. Because laws don't stop crimes. The only reason the criminal justice system exists is to identify criminal activity and set up a mechanism to punish criminals. Because the only thing that stops people from doing bad things is morality and force. But when we become so immoral as a society, we are incapable of governing ourselves, and then we ask for more laws. Even from our conservative circles, we ask for more laws. We say, hey, we need that law to protect children. We need that law to protect society. We need that law to keep us safe. I'm sorry, laws don't do that. Laws punish people. And if people are not afraid of the punishment, then it won't stop them from doing bad things. Because the only thing that stops people from doing things bad things is morality. But when you become immoral, what do? We need to understand the law, because the law is becoming immoral. And some people wouldn't like that I was different. It never really mattered how hard it would be, cause she filled me with love and the strength to leave. She said, let it burn, let it burn. I'm gonna burn something down if you get in our way.
The Chris Ann Hall Show. She's Liberty's lobbyist.
Well, we're having a little lesson today on law, and I hope that's okay. Because I teach all the time that we have this understanding that history repeats. And yet, when I see the evidence of that, it's still shocking. How precisely we repeat history. It's amazing to me, still, although I've spent 3 years pointing it out, evidence after evidence after evidence of how history repeats, it's still more shocking to know that we can still be overcome by such great, great ignorance. And we have to discuss this fact that laws can become immoral. And what do we do when laws become immoral? So here's this question, because I posted on my Facebook page yesterday a story about a 75-year-old man who had $80,000 taken from him by his government for zoning fines. Zoning fines. $80,000. How is that possible? That zoning fines can accrue to be $80,000. Zoning fines. You just have to think about this. $80,000 worth of fines relating to the use of his property. When taxes become so egregious that they remove your property, then guess what? You don't own your property. It's interesting because, you know, our framers warned us of this. Daniel Webster argued in 1819 that if the government had an unlimited power to tax, it had an unlimited power to destroy. Because if the government can tax with no limit, then there's no way to own property without the government's permission. And what is a fine but another word for a tax? You see, here's the problem. When you are taxed beyond your ability to defend your property, then that's no longer a moral law. That is an immoral law. And what do we do when laws become immoral? Daniel Webster was arguing that even the state can't do this. And here we have this 75-year-old man who is disputing fines. He has an attorney. There is a lawsuit. But what do you do when the government has the power to tax, the power to prosecute, and the power to sit in judgment of its laws? And then show up with military-style force at your doorstep, take you to the bank, hold a gun at your head, and make you withdraw $80,000 and hand it over to the police. Hey, if I showed up at your house and put a gun to your head, escorted you to the bank, and told you that at the teller's stand that you had to remove $80,000 and hand it to me, what would that be called? This man was fined $500 a day. $500 a day. How is that moral? How is that lawful? What was he doing? Was he sacrificing children in the front yard? Was he going house to house and stealing people's property and then displaying it in his own? What could he have possibly been doing to warrant a fine of $500 a day? And yet, when I post this on Facebook, I mean, as far as Facebook posts go, it goes pretty viral, right? 335 shares. Facebook tells me that, how many people have seen this? 106,000 people have seen this post. Do you know why it's gone viral? Because the defenders of the law got a hold of this. And they've made it about, oh, well, he was violating the law. So this is a warranted theft of the government. Really? And then you have your... by the way, it's rather funny, just as a side note, that sarcasm doesn't actually play well on Facebook, I think. Lots of people miss it. And especially those people who operate on emotion rather than on cognitive thought. And so I think part of the reason that this post went viral was because we have a situation where people of the liberal persuasion act by emotion rather than on cognitive thought. And there's a statement in the post. Well, let me just read it. It says, the IRS is seizing bank accounts. County tax collectors are evicting people from their homes and selling them, and now this. Can we officially cancel the 4th of July celebrations? Oh, that's right. Everything will be just fine when Obama's out of office. Shake my head. And so those who operate on emotion instead of cognitive thought start posting, oh, I guess it's all Obama's thought. You guys are false. You guys are you know, plugged into Fox News, and, you know, it's got to be Obama's fault, and this is not the IRS. Well, it's obviously this is not the IRS. I said it's not the IRS. But you see, if you only see one post, as Facebook only allows you to see, instead of the collective posts of the day, which shows you the series of articles that created the theme for this day, then you understand this is just another series of takings by local and federal government. And so you get these people that are like, oh, you're just blaming it on Obama. No, you idiot, it's sarcasm. But when you work on emotion rather than cognitive thought, you miss that. But then you have these things that say, well, he was in violation of zoning laws. Really? I just want to ask you, what could he possibly have been doing that warranted $500 a day fines? Should he have just given up and allowed the government to dictate what he can do and what he cannot do with his property? Because remember, property is a natural right. It's interesting, you know, the history that I teach, the history of liberty, the Magna Carta. I'm sure most of you have heard of the Magna Carta. But what was the purpose of the Magna Carta? The Magna Carta was designed by the people to tell the government, you can't do this because it's evil and oppressive, and then give the people the power, the force to limit government through the Royal Council. So you can't do these things, say the Royal Council of the people. See, the Royal Council was a council of people who could sit in the king's court and tell the king, no, you can't do that because it's evil and oppressive. And one of the things that the Magna Carta said was, for a trivial offense, a freeman shall be fined only in proportion to the degree of his offense, and for a serious offense correspondingly, but not so heavily as to deprive him of his livelihood. In the same way, a merchant shall be spared his merchandise, and a husbandman the implements of his husbandry. You see, the Magna Carta said, when your government fines you out of proportion to your offense, and takes your livelihood, your property, that is an evil and oppressive government. Apparently in 1215, we understood that $500 a day a fine is an evil and oppressive government. How is it that today, when a man is deprived of his property, $80,000, $500,000 a day, that can run up to a fines of $100,000, how is it that in 1215 we understood that that was the definite mark of an evil and oppressive government, but today we actually argue in favor of that? Oh, well, he was violating the law. The law is immoral. What do you do when that happens? Bastiat said, there is in all of us a strong disposition to regard what is lawful as legitimate, so much so that many falsely derive all justice from law. It is sufficient, then, for the law to order and sanction plunder, that it may appear to many consciences just and sacred. Slavery, protection, and monopoly find defenders, not only in those who profit by them, but in those who suffer by them. Why? Because it's the law. And law means justice. Bastiat said, if you suggest a doubt as to the morality of these institutions, it is said directly, you are a dangerous innovator. a utopian, a theorist, a despiser of the laws. You would shake the basis upon which society rests. And here we are, fulfilling Bastiat's prophecy because we've become ignorant of who we are. Ignorant of the fact that laws can become immoral. That when we start deriving all justice from law, we will sanction plunder. And I'm sorry, that's what's happened to this 75-year-old man. The government is plundering him. We have removed his inherent right to life, liberty, and property, his inherent right to protect those things. And it's okay, because the law says so. And because I am telling you that's not so, because I am telling you that law has become slavery, law has become the mechanism by which your rights are eliminated, because I'm trying to teach you of this truth, I am the one who is the enemy. I am the one who is advocating for the destruction of law. No, I am defending the natural law. And society remains silent at its plunder. That's not our purpose here. We must stand for life, liberty, and property and the right to defend them.
The Chris Ann Hall Show. She's liberty's lobbyist. Chris Ann Hall Show. She's Liberty's lobbyist.
I just have to say this again because it is just so stunningly real. Bastiat wrote, "There is in all of us a strong disposition to regard what is lawful as legitimate, so much so that many falsely derive all justice from law. It is sufficient then for the law to order sanction and plunder, that it may appear to many consciences just and sacred. Slavery, protection, and monopoly find defenders. Not only in those who profit by them, but those who suffer by them. If you suggest a doubt as to the morality of these institutions, it is said directly, you are a dangerous innovator, an utopian, a theorist, a despiser of the laws. You would shake the basis upon which society rests." No, the basis upon which society rests is not law. The basis upon which society rests is natural law. The right of the people to have life, liberty, and property. The right of the people, the self-evident right that we have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And when laws become contrary to those means, Jefferson said, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish. Bastiat said, "No law, no society can exist unless the laws are respected to a certain degree. But the safest way to make them respected is to make them respectable. When law and morality are in contradiction to each other, the citizen finds himself in the cruel alternative of either losing his moral sense or of losing his respect for the law. Two evils of equal magnitude between which it would be difficult to choose. And that's why you cannot falsely derive all justice from law. And that's why we must know that it is unlawful for the law to order and sanction plunder, because it's contrary to our conscience and leaves the people at a conundrum. Do I then follow the law, which is immoral? Or do I follow my morality and oppose the law? Well, this is what our framers did, by the way. We teach our children in our school books now that our framers were nothing but a bunch of rich white guys who wanted to avoid paying their taxes. No, the problem was the law had become a mechanism of plunder, denying people their life, their liberty, and their property. And the colonists said, no, we have a right to life, liberty, and property, which supersedes the plunder of the law. And therefore, we must not submit to the law because it is against our conscience. James Otis Jr. said, I submit myself to every name for odious name for conscience sake. Why? You can call me whatever you want. A rebel, an anarchist, a seditionist, a domestic terrorist. But the problem is the law has become the domestic terrorist. The government has become the domestic terrorist through the push of an immoral law that plunders us. Without our life, our liberty, our property, there is no purpose of living. And a law which exists to sanction slavery or monopoly, oppression or plunder in any form, cannot exist under the rights of men. And morality must then supersede our desire to follow the law. Because we have forgotten the purpose of law is to protect life, liberty, and property. And when that becomes a contradiction, we must revert to the original premise that the purpose of law is to protect life, liberty, and property, not to plunder it. And it is our natural right to defend our life, liberty, and our property in the best means possible. It is our natural right to say, I am supporting my law by not following this law. Just ask Rosa Parks. Just ask Mahatma Gandhi. Just ask Martin Luther King. It works. We came to light it up.